part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm gonna do it part. I'm gonna do it part-time. I'm gonna do it part. Fanboy.com.
Well, thank you for coming on to Part-Time Fanboy. I really appreciate you doing this.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome.
Just for anyone listening, I have on the line Buzz Dixon, who is, well, you've written a lot of stuff, a writer of animation, comic books, just about everything. But most importantly to me, within the past month and a half, you worked on G.I. Joe and the Transformers.
Yes.
And you were at the Egyptian screening answering mm-hmm. questions for fans. And yeah. You told a lot of really neat stories. And I was lucky enough to run into you at WonderCon. And you've agreed to come on Part-Time Fanboy. So thank you for that.
Well, I'm happy to do that. I'm happy to do it.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, so, I mean, I guess I have, I don't know if it's like a ton of questions, but I guess can we just maybe start from the beginning? Like, are you from, like, where did you get an interest in writing in general? Like, how did you end up sort of pursuing that career choice?
Well, that's a very good question to ask, because when I was a little boy, like most little boys, I was infatuated with dinosaurs, and I actually wrote my first book before I even knew how to read and write.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I had all of these books that my parents and my grandmother and aunt had purchased for me with dinosaurs in them, and I would draw my version of the dinosaurs on paper, and then very carefully, even though I didn't know my alphabet, copy the names that were written underneath them. Uh-huh. And so I put all this together and stapled it together with a cover on it, and that was my first book, so to speak. So I was interested in doing something creatively like that before I even went to school.
Uh-huh.
In school, I gravitated towards science fiction and started writing short stories and whatnot. I tried cracking the science fiction markets, you know, when I was a teenager, and I had no success at that point.
Uh-huh.
I did write for some fanzines. I okay. wrote reviews and I wrote a few articles and whatnot. But then when I was drafted in the Army in 1972, I ended up being, because of the limited experience I had, you know, writing for fanzines and whatnot, they ended up making me a newspaper editor.
Oh,
so
wow.
You talk about going from zero to 60.
Yeah.
So I edited a Post newspaper for about a year, and then I was in a public affairs office at Fort Huachuca, Arizona.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, from there, I polished my writing. I kept working at it, trying to get better at it. When I came out to Los Angeles in 1978, when I left the Army, I came to Los Angeles to go to USC's film school.
Oh, okay.
And I had been accepted by the film school, but the film school wasn't going to be starting until October. So we were in Los Angeles in late February, early March, and I decided I'll get a job at one of the studios, you know, in the mail department, a driver, or something like that, just something to familiarize myself with the studio system a bit before going to school.
Uh-huh.
So I started hitting every studio. I started with, like, Universal and just began working my way on down. And I eventually ended up at Filmation Studios.
Okay.
And they were a very low budget, well, I'll be kind. I'll say they were an extremely economical animation studio.
Okay.
But they also did some live action. And when I went in, they were, you know, on seasonal hiatus. They weren't doing any new work. But Arthur Nadell, who was the producer, their live-action producer, he figured, well, I'll talk to this guy. I don't have anything on my schedule. Let him come in. And we talked, and I told him I had been writing some short stories. And he told me about a TV series that they had sold that they were having difficulty coming up with ideas for the stories.
Uh-huh.
They had sold a thing called, now I can to this day, I cannot keep the name straight. Starlight and Moonbright or something like that.
Okay.
Or Sunlight and Starbright. Or the premise was it was two teenage girls who had superpowers, but one of them had superpowers in the daytime and the other had superpowers at nighttime.
That's great.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing was they could never come up with anything for these, you know, characters to do. They just had superpowers. They just couldn't figure out what to do with them.
Gotcha. They had the concepts, but they didn't have right. like plots and stuff. Yeah.
So I had given Arthur a couple of my short stories that I had written, and then I developed some ideas for the show and let him see those. And what I didn't know was that Arthur had sent my short stories to Hawaii, where Lou Scheimer, who was the producer of Filmation, was yeah. He was the head producer, was on vacation. So he sent Lou some copies of my stories. And then when Lou came back, he had the premises that I had written for the show on Lou's desk. And Lou says, I don't know who we should hire, if we should hire the guy who wrote the short stories or the guy who wrote the premises. And Arthur said, it's the same guy. And Lou said, get him.
That's
so
great.
They hired me, and I ended up never going to film school. I just started writing, and I went from Filmation Studios to Ruby Spears, and then from Ruby Spears to a variety of different places, finally ending up at Sunbow. I've written live action. I've written animation. I've written video games. I have books coming out this year. So I've done a little bit of everything.
Yeah, yeah. You've done a lot of everything. I mean, I just looked up your – I looked them up before, but, you know, after the screening, you know, just to see what's going on. But I kind of, you know, refreshed my memory this morning, and I was like – I mean, you worked on the Mighty Orbots. Like, mm-hmm, that to
yes.
me was just like – I almost fell out of my chair because that's a series that I loved as a kid. You know, when I was younger, I just loved the animation and stuff, and I managed, you can't get them, you know, legally, like they're not on DVD, but as you know, comic conventions,
oh yeah,
you can get anything. So I brought yeah. one of those home. The quality wasn't great, but I showed them to my daughter, and she loved them. So yeah. like you've worked on a lot of different stuff. Was there any kind of, I guess one of the questions that I had for you, because you were sort of working in animation, like what, like 70s, 80s?
78 was when I started.
Okay. Yeah. And so was there any kind of, was it looked down upon to like write
oh,
an animation?
Oh, you better
believe it. Oh, really?
Are you kidding? Yeah. I mean, it was like one step up from porn.
Oh, no way. Really? That bad?
Yeah, I mean, it was like Filmation Studios, and I will say this because Lou is no longer with us, and so
yeah.
I can't hurt his feelings. Filmation Studios was regarded, there was only two types of people working there, those on their way in and those on the way out.
Oh,
and
really?
There were a lot of people who started their careers at Filmation who went on to do really great stuff. But if you had any, and I'm not saying this in a self-congratulatory tone, I'm just being frank, if you had any talent and ability, you were soon hired away by somebody else, somebody who
oh.
could pay a lot more for your talent and ability.
Yeah.
Conversely, if you were an old-timer and you were just clinging on by your fingernails, Lou, God bless him, would see that, you know, you had some place to work, even though you may no longer have the freshest ideas or the you know, necessary energy to really do the best job possible.
Sure.
We had a guy there named Bill Danch, and Bill Danch goes all the way back to radio.
Oh, wow.
And there was a TV show, a radio show called Fibber McGee and Molly.
Uh-huh.
And they had like regular characters, and the characters would just like walk into the house and interact, you know, in a scene and then walk out. And so whatever the theme of that show was, each character that would come in would have a scene based on whatever the theme of the show was. And his job was the bratty next door neighbor, the little girl who lived next door.
Okay.
And so he was like writing this 8-year-old's dialogue for this show, and he would you know, he'd do all the scenes where she would come in, cause problems for Fibber McGee and whatnot, and then
uh-huh.
he'd chase her out, and then another neighbor would come in and they'd do a scene with that neighbor.
Uh-huh.
Bill also wrote the first science fiction film that Roger Corman ever produced, Monster from the Ocean Floor.
Oh, wow.
And he was bitter to his dying day about Corman cheating him out of money.
He was
Oh yeah, Danch was just, he was an acerbic old guy. I mean, I loved him, but he was, man, he was cranky.
So you ran into a lot of characters in
Oh my goodness, yeah.
I mean, beyond the characters that were being created. I mean, just for anyone who doesn't know, and, you know, Filmation is like, well, I knew them for like He-Man, and they did like the Archie stuff. And
right.
They did, I don't know.
They did Tarzan. Like, they did Fat Albert.
Fat Albert. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my interesting story, just to put things in perspective, at the 78 Christmas party at Filmation, I was talking to Bill and Lou about, you know, doing Fat Albert, and I asked them, I said, what's it like working with Bill Cosby?
Uh-oh.
And they both looked at me and said, don't ever mistake the real man for his public persona.
Oh, wow.
They said he's not off camera who he is on camera.
Wow.
And they wouldn't go further than that. You know, they said, yeah, we'd work with him if, you know, there was a deal in place.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't like they were lifelong buddies and they were, you know, hoping to hang out with him and things like that. They had a very professional arms length relationship.
Oh wow, that's interesting. But they did. But Filmation just did like a ton of stuff.
My goodness! Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they were like all over the Saturday morning TV cartoon. So there must have been like some success, right? I mean,
they had a great deal of success. They did the first straight superhero show.
Uh-huh.
They did the very first version of Superman.
Yeah, that's right.
Animated Superman. For TV, there had been obviously the animated cartoons in the 30s and 40s, and what had happened was Lou had been a background painter for Hanna-Barbera, and Hanna-Barbera was offered, I don't know, they were offered, let's just say, 8 half-hours on Saturday morning by the various networks, and they said, well, we can't do all 8 half-hours, you know, we can only do like 7 half-hours or something like that.
Yeah.
And Lou went to the network, and mind you, he's just a background painter.
Yeah.
He says, I can put together a show for you, and you know, we can fill one of those half hours.
Oh, wow.
And I forget how he managed to get his hands on Superman. I can't recall if the network had the rights to Superman and was just looking for a studio to animate it, or if he somehow approached them. But in any case, he did Superman, and it was successful. I mean, you have to work really hard, as Warner Brothers has proven, to make a bad Superman.
I don't disagree with you.
So he got that rolling. He did a ton of other things. They did everything from you know, funny animal cartoons. They did Star Trek. They did Star Trek the animated series, where they brought back all the voice actors. They brought back a lot of the writers. They were able. The quality of the animation was not as good as one might hope for, but the imaginativeness of the layouts, the designs, the characters and whatnot, that was very good. That was very interesting. I mean, for the first time, Star Trek really looked as imaginative as it could, as you would want it to look.
Yeah.
And then they did their live action stuff. They did, let's see, if I'm trying to remember it here.
Shazam?
I think they first did, Shazam.
And
I was going to say
ISIS?
Captain Marvel, but you're right.
Oh, yeah.
Shazam.
Sorry.
It's okay. No, you're right, because I was going to misremember it.
No.
They did ISIS.
Yeah.
I got to tell you a funny story about that.
I never
worked on their live action stuff.
Okay.
But a friend of mine, a guy named Michael Reeves, was like their favorite writer for ISIS, because Michael Reeves figured out you could have the biggest stories in the world as long as ISIS was making things not happen. For example, if there's an earthquake and the bridge is going to collapse, she just flies up and says magically, bridge, do not collapse.
Oh, wow.
Dam, don't burst. Building, don't fall down.
That's great.
He did all these shows where she kept bad things from happening. You know,
yeah.
Go, yeah, great. You know, that saves us a ton on special effects. Go for it.
Yeah. Oh, it's really funny because I know that ISIS is another thing that I've sat down and enjoyed with my daughter, mm-hmm. and I've showed her some of the Filmation stuff, and it's really funny because you say like that there was this stigma against like working in or writing for animation, but mm-hmm. still you guys or whoever, you know, the people that worked in those companies, you know, Filmation, Sunbow, you know, Hanna-Barbera, they influenced more people than probably a lot of live action, like, you know, primetime stuff, wouldn't you say?
I would say in certain areas, absolutely right. I mean, let us be honest. There were some like really bad animated shows out there that everybody has forgotten, and justifiably so. and there are others that resonated. It connects somehow with people, and it keeps ringing true to this day. Yeah. I mean, you look at one of my favorite examples. Besides the Flintstones, they do the Jetsons, and the Jetsons was only on for one season.
Yeah.
The Flintstones was on for a long time. The Jetsons was only on for one season, and yet you mention the Jetson characters, everybody knows who the Jetsons are.
Yeah.
It just sunk in. There was something about that sunk its hooks in deep into popular culture. What animation can do and do really well is that it streamlines characters and stories and concepts down to their most basic elements.
Uh-huh.
And that stuff, when you're reaching people at an impressionable young age, that can really sink in and it can really stick with people.
Yeah.
One of the things that I have, I won't say on my conscience, but something I think about, when we did G.I. Joe, we're fighting this ruthless terrorist organization out to conquer the world.
Yeah.
And we did, man, we must have done like 80 some episodes. I forget how many we did.
It's a lot.
Of G.I. Joe. Every day we're inoculating in kids the idea that there is a ruthless terrorist organization out to conquer the world.
Uh-huh.
Now, I'm not saying we caused people to think about Al-Qaeda that way, but when it was presented, we've got to fight them because they're a ruthless terrorist organization, the idea of fighting, using the military to fight terrorists, that was an idea that had sunk in by that point. I mean,
sure.
We were like 20 years ahead of the curve, so 15 years ahead of the curve on this. But the generation of young men and women who went off to fight in Afghanistan and Iraq, they were kids watching TV when we were doing G.I. Joe.
Uh-huh.
And I have wondered to myself, how much influence did I have on decisions they made in their lives? I mean, because if nothing else, I may have encouraged people to put their lives in harm's way, you know, to make a career of the military and whatnot. I've had people, I was at a G.I. Joe convention in Texas last year,
uh-huh.
and military, I mean, it was astonishing how many guys there in cosplaying as G.I. Joe characters
sure.
were active duty military.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was astonishing. And all of them had been heavily influenced by G.I. Joe when they were kids.
Wow.
And I was talking with someone about this, and he said, take away from it that you inspired people to sacrifice for their country and to aspire to heroism. And he says, don't try to, you know, take the burdens of, you know, bad policy decisions on your back.
Well, absolutely.
But, I mean, it's a thought that has crossed my mind. What have I written? What have I done that I may have thought it was harmless and it may have had, like, you know, lasting impact in somebody's life?
Sure. Well, here's the thing is, like, and obviously now we're, like, going into a whole, like, other sort of, like, you know, conversation as far as, like, the deeper meaning of, like, you know, what the stuff that you create and what it does when you put it out into the world, right? But
mm-hmm.
the thing is don't you feel like, especially in the 80s, that was already a part of the narrative? Like, that was kind of like, I mean, we've had war movies since, you know, the 40s and John Wayne and all that stuff. Like, it just feels like G.I. Joe was just like not adding on to that, but sort of like a, and not even like a part of the continuum.
Yes,
like, and I
acknowledge that. Yes.
Yeah.
And I recognize that. you know, the Rambo movies were really big at that point. Chuck Norris broke through as a big action star at that point, and several of his films were military oriented, where either like Invasion USA, he's fighting terrorists on U.S. soil, and what was the one he did with Lee Marvin? Delta Force.
Yes. Okay.
You know, and both are entertaining action films. I mean, I just watched last year. I saw Invasion USA again, and I thought to myself, you know, this actually is not a bad action movie. I mean, he you know, Chuck Norris is clearly operating under psychic influence here, because he's always where the bad guys are without explanation, and just able to thwart them, you know, with ridiculous ease.
Yeah,
but it was an entertaining movie. It was a good popcorn muncher.
Sure.
Yes, there have always been war films and war stories and whatnot. It was the specifics of that phrase, ruthless terrorist organization.
Oh, gotcha.
We had patterned Cobra very much after Hydra from Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
And Hydra was a derivative of Spectre from the James Bond movies.
Yeah, okay.
And even before that, you had all of these pulp, you know, adventures where there was, you know, a secret organization of bad guys who were, you know, trying to do something nefarious.
Sure.
We had taken it very specifically into a military scale type of story.
Gotcha.
The Bond movies, you know, like You Only Live Twice is the best example, I think. The Bond movies, you've got typically in the story, there's a major superpower secretly funding something that Spectre is doing. Spectre has offered to do something for a major superpower. They'll be the guys getting their hands dirty.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the Chinese give Spectre a bunch of money, and Spectre goes out and they build a rocket base in a volcano, and then, you know, James Bond and the ninjas have to show up and, you know, battle their way into the volcano and blow up stuff. And, you know, all very entertaining and whatnot. But they at least acknowledged this sort of thing can't happen at this scale without a major superpower backing it.
Gotcha.
You just don't have people on their own building rocket bases, building submarine bases, doing all this stuff unless there's somebody who can protect them.
Okay.
And in the G.I. Joe comics, when they first came out, there were allusions to that.
Sure.
Cobra was under somebody's protection, and it was impossible to root them out completely because basically they had somebody covering for them.
Yeah.
The G.I. Joe series, we were never allowed to go into that.
Sure.
I won't say we weren't allowed to go into it, but when we tried to go into it, they threw us a curveball with Serpentor.
Yeah.
And we ended up creating this whole mythos that I wish we had not gone in that direction. We never examined where Cobra came from and how does it work, how does it function.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with the Cartoon Network series The Venture Brothers.
Yes, of course.
Well, they've got, you know, the League of Calamitous Intent, which is their equivalent of, you know, Cobra, Spectre, Hydra, whatever you want to say. And they've done the best job, I think, of anybody who's done that sort of thing, because they've actually sat down and said, in our world, how would such a thing function? How would they work?
Uh-huh.
And you realize from that series, both sides are equally corrupt. Good and evil are equally corrupt in that series.
Uh-huh.
It's just that one side is arbitrary the good guys, and the other side is arbitrary the bad guys, and you just pick a team and you join it. And, you know, it's not like one side really represents something worthwhile and the other one doesn't.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they're like fighting each other, and then they've got their whole support system of how they get henchmen and their, you know, I mean, it's just, I was laughing at this because they were doing so much stuff that we kind of threw away jokes about in G.I. Joe.
Yeah.
But they actually delve into it. They actually go into, well, they do have a health program. They do have, you know,
well, isn't that part of, like, farce and, like, comedy is sort of, like, picking something apart that hasn't really been examined thoroughly?
Exactly, but
One of the things I wanted to ask you, because you're kind of going into this, and you know, it was obviously you were in that industry 70s, 80s, and I know that there was a lot of controversy with a lot of, like, Saturday morning or afternoon TV, like, you know, people worried about the violence. People worried about, like, these are commercials for toys. People worried about, like, did you ever see anything, or were you involved in anything, like, since you were writing a lot of these shows, was there any kind of, like, worry going on at these different companies?
Oh, my goodness, like, yes. You would not believe it.
Yeah.
First off, one of the things that I have to give major credit to both Lou Scheimer and Art Nadel was that at Filmation, they had decided on their own, we are not going to go for cheap and easy violence. And a lot of the shows, we were very frustrated because we were not allowed to do, you know, just common sense type things.
Okay.
If you're doing an action adventure show, you have to acknowledge there's going to be some conflict in it. There's going to be some, you know, struggles and fisticuffs and this and that.
Sure.
And we would get these weird notes from the networks. I mean, you couldn't have anything that looked like a realistic gun.
Okay.
That you would shoot at somebody. You couldn't use real weapons like spears and clubs and things like that. You could use bizarre weapons. You know, you could invent something that, you know, nobody has, and you could use that. You couldn't fight. You couldn't throw a punch, but you could push people. You could grapple with them. You could duck when they jump at you and they sail over your head and bounce into something.
Yeah.
There was a show. ABC gave. There were a group of people who claimed they could write, you know, they could come up with the perfect nonviolent TV show.
Uh-huh.
And they came up with this show called The Little Clowns of Happy Town, which is...
Oh, God. Sounds like a horror movie.
God, was it ever.
Oh, jeez.
I mean, and this show was so nonviolent, the clowns could not throw pies. They could put a pie down on the ground and another clown could trip and fall face first into it.
Oh, come on.
And yeah, I mean, it was like awful.
Yeah.
Anyway, you couldn't do the kind of action that you did with, like, Johnny Quest. Okay.
Sure.
Johnny Quest level stuff strictly verboten at that point.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Because Johnny Quest was kind of like one of the first, like, right? Like one of the first action cartoons, right?
But they got at a certain point where you have to recognize between something being clearly a cartoon and clearly not being real and, you know, being something that's imitatable violence.
Uh-huh.
And there was like I forget the name of it. There's like this Hillbilly Bear show that Hanna-Barbera did, and they had these muzzle-loading rifles, and they would be chasing one another, shooting these rifles just repeatedly without reloading, just blam, 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 you know, just shot after shot would come out, and it's like, well, it's a muzzle-loading rifle, and they're firing it endlessly. I mean, it's clearly a cartoon. It has nothing to do with reality.
Yeah.
It's paint on cells of talking bears. I mean,
you know...
Don't worry about that. That's not an important thing to worry about. On the other hand, if you do a story where it's, even if it's a cartoon, it's fairly realistic, and you have a kid getting picked on, and he goes home and he gets a knife out of his mom's, you know, kitchen, and goes back and stabs the guy that was picking on him, then you go, okay, whoa, that's too much of a specific idea. You don't want to put that idea in some kid's head.
Sure.
You know, they'll come up with it on their own, I'm sure, but you don't want to be responsible for saying, go get a knife and stab the guy picking on you.
Yeah.
So they went from common sense boundaries to just ridiculous boundaries. We were doing a show with Jack Kirby at Ruby Spears called... What was not
Thundar?
No, but besides Thundar.
Oh, really?
This was a show that didn't get on the air.
Oh, okay.
A show called Oh my goodness! It was a ripoff. Roxy's Raiders.
Roxy's Raiders. Okay.
It was a ripoff of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh really?
And it would have been a cool show if we could have gotten it on the air, because Roxy was a teenage girl who had inherited a circus, and the Raiders were all of these circus freaks that helped her on these various adventures.
Oh, that's a great idea.
But anyway, and you, oh my goodness, you should have seen what Jack was doing with it.
I'm sure.
It's just incredible stuff. But In one of the episodes we're doing, the bad guy has tied Roxy to a stake in a pool of water that's about chest high.
Yeah.
And he releases a moray eel, two moray eels, into the water.
Yeah.
And the network said, when he opens the cage to release the eels, you have to have a big rock between the cage and Roxy so the eels can't see Roxy the moment they come out of the cage. Because if he opens it, if they see her when he opens it, then he's deliberately trying to hurt her. But if he just opens a cage and they happen to swim out and they happen to see her when they go around the rock, that's different. And it's like,
he's
tied her up in a pool of water and he's releasing flipping eels.
Yeah.
Come on, what do you think he's doing here?
Yeah.
You know.
So what do you think changes from the filmation days to like all the way to Sunbow and even like Thundar, which you worked on, or various other things? Because like Thundar's got like the light sword, right? Which is, and then
it's a non-realistic weapon because it was carried as a hilt only on his arm, and the moment he whips it out, the blade comes out like a lightsaber.
Uh-huh.
So it ceased being a real weapon. It was a fantasy weapon, and in that context, it was okay.
Huh. Then how do you get away with G.I. Joe? Because one of the really great things with G.I. Joe, I know that they were shooting lasers and stuff like that, but everything looked realistic, like the tanks, the vehicles, the armor,
I can explain it in three words.
What is it?
Money changes everything.
Oh, really? What happened?
What had happened? I'll back up a bit. There had always been a connection between popular media and toys.
Okay.
There had always been a tie-in. I mean, going all the way back to the very first comic strips, there were toy dolls, there were, cars. I mean, Buck Rogers was selling toy ray pistols back in the 1920s.
Sure,
okay?
Sure.
So there was always this connection. And it had existed in television. And frequently in television, what would happen would be somebody would cook up an idea for a show, and they would either pitch it to a network who would buy it, and then they would pitch it to a toy company who would develop it as a toy simultaneously, or a toy company would have an idea, and they would pitch it to the network, and the network would give it to a studio to develop as a series.
Uh-huh.
And what had happened was this had been going on not all the time, but it had been happening frequently enough. And there was a show called Hot Wheels, based on the Hot Wheels toys. I mean, you can't get more generic than toy cars.
Sure,
okay?
sure.
So the Hot Wheels show, for some reason, it just triggered the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC.
Yeah.
And they said, you cannot have a network broadcast show that is based on a toy. You cannot show something that's based on a toy. You can show something that's based on a pre-existing literary property, but not a toy. So that brought the toy shows to a halt for about 5 or 6 years.
Gotcha.
And what had happened was, the Smurfs came along.
Okay.
And the Smurfs were huge in Europe. They were very popular. And the little tchotchkes, the toys, the key rings and whatnot, started selling in the United States. And nobody knew what a Smurf was. They just knew, here are these cute, funny, little blue guys.
Yeah.
And they wanted to do a TV show based on the Smurfs. And they realized, well, we can't do it because it's a toy. And then someone said, no, it was originally a Belgian comic book.
Oh,
really?
Wow.
And so immediately they go into production with the Smurfs. And when the critics said, hey, you're basing it on a toy, oh, no. Look, here's the Belgian comic book,
Wow.
And so they did the end run. Well, the moment they did that, Strawberry Shortcake was a character in a series of greeting cards. Okay. She wasn't a toy. She was
a character. Oh, I did not know that.
She was a character in a series of greeting cards. And the Strawberry Shortcake people said, well, greeting cards are a literary property. And they go, okay, all right, fine. You can do Strawberry Shortcake.
Yeah.
And then Filmation and Mattel went to DC Comics and says, we've got a toy coming out. And before we launch the toy, we want you to do a comic book on it. And there was like a three-issue He-Man comic book that came out of DC that, other than the characters having similar names and a somewhat similar appearance because they were based on early variations of the characters, no resemblance to what Filmation did.
Yeah, I remember them, yeah.
But it was out. They had three issues. And the moment they got the three issues in the can, boom, okay, now start producing the toy. Now do the TV show. And if anybody complains, hey, comic book.
Holy cow.
That's the same thing that happened with G.I. Joe. Hasbro wanted to launch Transformers and G.I. Joe. And they went to Marvel. They got comic book deals to do, you know, comic book series for both, you know, both properties.
Yeah.
And at that point, they then started approaching the syndication market as opposed to the networks to do G.I. Joe. Because the syndication market, the way it worked, it was called barter.
Yeah.
And what you would do, you would make a TV show and you would go to them and say, we'll give you this TV show for free if you let us sell advertising on it. You can sell half the advertising time locally. We'll sell half the advertising time nationally.
Uh-huh.
And so you're going to a TV station and you're basically saying, hey, free half-hour programming and you'll make some money on it. Well, of course, the guys are going to say yes.
Yeah.
So they went for these shows, and that's how the whole syndication market worked.
Wow.
In fact, it worked so well, the Gem series, the TV series, was immensely popular.
Yeah.
The toy died a horrible screaming death.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, it was just like the ugliest fashion doll anybody had ever designed. You know,
I'm
just being brutal about it. I mean, We would get big boxes of toys from Hasbro, and since I had daughters, I would be bringing home the Little Ponies and the Gem dolls.
Sure.
And they're like, oh,
really?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just like no, you know. Anyway, the Gem TV series, however, was so popular that even after the toy was canceled, they kept Gem on the air for a second year with brand new episodes. Because their audience was so great. They could sell advertising and make a profit selling the advertising.
Yeah.
So even though the toy was a dud, the show was a hit and it kept going.
Wow, that's amazing. Like, so yeah, I guess Gem, I mean, I know it's on Netflix and stuff now, but that was a really popular. How many episodes did Gem go?
Wow. Let's see.
And did you write on it? You wrote on Gem as well?
Yeah, I wrote at least three.
Yeah.
I did one Gem too many. And I think I did one called Gem Jam, but I might be misremembering. Christy Marks may have written that one. The title, for some reason, pops out. And I either wanted to do a story with that name and was told Christy had already done one, or somebody had mentioned Christie's while I was doing something and it just stuck with me. I wrote at least three Gem episodes, and I think, boy, don't hold me to this, I think there was a total of like, oh, there would typically be like,
I could probably
do 13 weeks of five episodes, so we would have 65 half hours per season. And I don't know if Gem had the full season run, the two seasons it was out. But we did at least 60, 70 episodes.
Yeah, it looks like, you know, something like close to like 60, 70 something. Yeah, I just looked it up on Wikipedia. So let me ask you, this is one thing I was curious when I was at the Egyptian, because you talked about how Cobra Law kind of came to be, and I might ask you to reiterate that a little bit now. But my question for you is, like, when you are working on like a TV show that is a toy property, how does the sort of creative process work? Like, does Hasbro or whoever say, like, hey, we've got this guy, what was the guy with the wings? Avenger? Yeah.
Nemesis Enforcer.
Right. Whose action figure is nowhere near as cool as he was in the movie, because I looked it up on eBay after the... But anyway, do they say, like, we've got this guy, Nemesis Enforcer, or we've got Serpentor, and you write something about it? Do they have, like, designs on the toy, or do you come up with everything? How did it work?
Well, typically... And you have to understand, the movies are kind of a different category.
Sure.
So we'll put the movies aside for a moment.
Okay.
Typically on the shows, we would go in and we would be handed this huge, thick Bible, and the Bible would have like a one page. It would have a product sketch of whatever the character was, whether it was a Transformer or a Joe or Cobra figure. They'd have a picture of the character. They'd have the character's name. They would have the bio that Larry Hama wrote, because Larry Hama wrote all the bios for the characters for Hasbro.
Oh, really?
And then they would hand this to us, and you know, we'd go stuff like, "Oh, really? A homicidal maniac? Yeah, right. We can't have that."
Yeah.
But we would get this, and then we would try to translate it into animated characters. And as a result, there is a difference, as many people have pointed out, between the way that Larry interpreted the characters for comics, where it was assumed the readers were going to understand there was a lot more unspoken violence, so to speak, going on than the animated series.
Interesting.
You know, when you're reading the comic, you're assuming a lot of people are getting killed and whatnot, even if they don't come right out and say it.
Yeah.
With the animated show, we had to have at least the fig leaf of, you know, just as the missile's about to hit, somebody ejects from the airplane.
Yeah.
Stuff like this. Past that, the first couple of weeks, they would send us a product list of what they would want in a particular episode. And they'd say, we want an episode featuring these six characters, these vehicles, and these accessories. And after about like the second or third week, they realized, well, you know, these guys at Sunbow, you know, the writing staff, they're going to use every tool we hand them. We don't have to worry about them picking favorites. They're going through here and they're using everything they can find.
Yeah.
So they stopped telling us what to use, with certain exceptions. If a toy was going out of the product line, they would say these characters, you know, are not, you know, being made anymore, so you don't have to include them. These vehicles are no longer being made, so, you know, in the second season, don't refer to this kind of a tank or that kind of a tank, things like that.
Interesting.
We rarely created anything for the TV show that ended up in the product line. And I'm not going to say never ever, because I can't remember every single thing we did, but I don't recall us ever coming up with a character that hadn't already been developed by Hasbro with a toy in mind.
Oh, that's interesting.
Now, when the movie came along, Ron Friedman took the first swing at the script, and I forget what he did with it, but the only thing that we kept from Ron's script was Nemesis Enforcer, because Hasbro really liked that character, thought he was cool looking.
Gotcha.
They basically told me, just keep Nemesis Enforcer and come up with something new. And I hope I won't bore your audience, but as you remember, I'm trying to find out a way of introducing Serpentor to our audience for the first time, because for the first season of G.I. Joe, there's never been an indication that there's anything behind Cobra other than Cobra itself.
Yeah.
And so I was developing a story that was going to be called The Most Dangerous Man in the World, which was basically, it was the Karl Marx or the Friedrich Nietzsche of Cobra.
Yeah.
The guy who came up with the whole operating philosophy behind it. He escapes from Cobra's clutches, and Cobra's trying to find him, and the Joes don't know who he is or why he's important. They only know if Cobra wants him, we have to get him first. And so they eventually find him, and they discover that, you know, he was the guy who came up with the operating philosophy that Cobra Commander then perverted and turned into Cobra.
Yeah.
So Hasbro said, yeah, do that, and just work the Cobra Emperor in there.
Yeah.
And I said, the what? And they said, the Cobra Emperor. And I said, who's the Cobra Emperor? And, oh, he's the guy in charge of Cobra, above Cobra Commander. And I said, no, he's not.
Yeah.
And he, you know, we've had nobody except Cobra Commander as the superior, you know, officer in Cobra all this time. If you had told us in season one, you know, hint that there might be a bigger organization behind it, we'd have been happy to do that. We would have dropped clues everywhere, and then we could just fit something like that in seamlessly.
Sure.
But all this time, we've been presenting Cobra as, you know, a whole unto itself. And they go, yeah, that might be a problem. Yeah, I would think so. So they said, well, come up with an idea of how to introduce Serpentor.
Uh-huh.
And, well, they said, actually, come up with a couple of ideas.
Yeah.
And in retrospect, I should have just come up with the first idea that I liked and then told them this is the only thing I got.
Yeah.
And then they would have been stuck. I came up with two ideas. And the first one was that the rest of Cobra, frustrated at Cobra Commander's, you know, incompetence, decides to build a new Cobra leader, and that would be Serpentor. And they get the DNA from all of these great warriors in the past, and they mix them together, and they produce Serpentor.
Mm-hmm.
And the other idea was that there is a secret organization that even everybody except Cobra Commander in Cobra doesn't know exists.
Yeah.
And this secret organization had sent Cobra Commander out with orders to conquer the world, and now that he's failed, he's going to be held accountable to it.
Sure.
And when I was doing that, I was trying to think of where in the world would these people be located. And just to have a placeholder name to refer to them by, I said, yeah, this is Cobra Law, you know, because Shangri-La is the lost civilization in James Hilton's Lost Horizon, which is the most famous lost civilization in literature.
Sure.
Okay, I mean, it's you should know that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah.
And I figure, well, they'll see Cobra Law and they'll realize, oh, we see what he's doing there. He's just giving it a placeholder name.
Yeah.
They fell in love with the name.
Oops.
And I'm going, no, we cannot call it that. We can't call it Cobra Law. Nah, we like it. We're going to use it. So anyway, when I developed the Cobra Law story, I created Globulus.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if I came up with the name for the female villain or if someone else did.
Uh-huh.
I have a feeling Hasbro came up with her name, but I came up with the basic idea for her. And Pythona.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That was about the only two characters that I ever contributed that ended up anywhere in the toy line at all.
And oh, okay.
I'm not 100% sure that either one of them were mass-produced, but I'm under the impression at least one of them and Nemesis Enforcer were done as like a special promotional thing or something like that. Somebody who's more informed on the Joe toy line will correct me, I'm sure.
Well, I know Nemesis Enforcer has a figure for sure because I looked him up. And there's been more recent like casts or molds, but I just looked up Pythona on eBay and nothing came up. So
yeah. I know somebody did a mock-up. I mean, but I'm under the impression it was like a fan mock-up.
Gotcha.
Of Pythona. It was not the real thing, but they did it in a blister pack with the art in the background and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Which is another interesting thing, because now that you've got 3D printing and people can make their own toys and whatnot, there's really not a big incentive for major, huge toy companies the way that Mattel and Hasbro used to exist.
Yeah.
You know, people, I can see a future where there will be design studios that will design a toy.
Yeah.
And then you subscribe to them, and then you can download the toy and print it up in, you know, your own home and paint it however you want.
But yeah.
I just don't see 5 or 10 years from now we're going to have these huge product lines the way they used to have,
oh,
like
wow.
Transformers and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But anyway, that was the closest I came to creating characters that actually got translated into toys. All of the supporting characters that were introduced in the movie, those were all handed to me.
Gotcha.
You know, they said, we've got these characters. I may have contributed a couple of names because they weren't solid on the names yet. And I said, well, let's call them this or that. And they said, okay.
Uh-huh.
But for the most part, every character we had that was in uniform of some kind was produced by Hasbro, was originated at Hasbro and ended up, you know, on a sheet of paper for me to include in the movie.
Gotcha. What did you, and how did you think about that way of working? Was it like frustrating to you at all, or were you just like, I'm a kid in a candy store, like, you know, like,
well,
this
more
is great.
I'm a kid in a candy store, because the great thing about the second season of G.I. Joe,
uh-huh.
the thing that made it so much fun to write in the second season was we had 86 well, we had when I say speaking roles, we've obviously got characters like Snake Eyes who don't talk.
Yeah.
But we had like 86 or 87 product characters
uh-huh.
who appear in, you know, the toy line. And even if they had been cycled out of the toy line, we could bring them back if we had a reason to.
Yeah.
I think we brought Sparks back in season 2. And showed, well, after he left G.I. Joe, he started working for an electronics company, and now he was kind of like interfacing with the active duty Joes, giving him advice on, you know, some electronics thing.
Yeah.
And we had a couple of characters. We had a female character called Mary L., who we felt there weren't enough female Joes, and if we ever had a scene where we felt, well, we need at least one other female Joe just to indicate it isn't an all boys club. So we created a character called Mary L, who just every now and then pops up and has a line, but she really was never part of the product line.
Uh-huh.
And of course, Hector Ramirez.
Yeah.
I mean, Hector appears everywhere. That's the one character I'm surprised they didn't turn into an action figure. Maybe they did and they didn't tell me about it.
Oh, I don't know. I have no idea. Yeah. Wow, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is, like, because you usually, sometimes you'll hear people who work for, like, either comic book companies or, you know, TV shows and stuff like that. They're sort of like, they feel hamstringed in, or what is the phrase I'm looking for?
Hamstrung, yeah.
Hamstrung in, excuse me, in my English, hello. But, you know, by what they're forced to work with. But for you, it was more like, oh, I can just go crazy with these characters.
It depends entirely upon the company that you're working with and what their objectives are.
Yeah.
We did, when I was at Ruby Spears, we did a show called Mr. T.
Yes.
And it was where he solves
mysteries.
That's
right, mysteries. Mr. T. Yeah.
And there were, I'm not exaggerating, there were 17 regular characters in the show, and every single one of them had to have a line of dialogue in every episode.
Uh-huh.
So by the time you got through every character having their one line of dialogue, the show's over.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was really difficult. We had 17 characters, and every single one had to be used. And the nice thing about Transformers and G.I. Joe, you couldn't possibly put every character in every episode. So
yeah.
You go, okay, as long as you're constantly going through the list, as long as everybody gets, you know, a star turn at some point, just use the characters as they come to you. You know, if you've got a story that works for this character, use him.
Yeah, yeah.
And by the second season, we had such a rich cast of characters in terms of personality, outlook, how they would do things. If we wanted to do a show, we'd go, okay, well, who would be the best character to throw in this? And we just go through the list, find the character, and stick them in there.
Yeah.
And as long as we kept that, as long as we kept that mix fresh, as long as we were like constantly rotating it, doing things, we never had a problem.
Yeah.
Other shows, like I said, you know, the Mr. T thing, it's like 17 characters. Come on, you know, just.
And each of them had to get their time in.
Exactly. Yeah. You kids stay in the bus. I'm going to go solve this mystery.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. So how did does the dynamic change from, like, say, G.I. Joe the series to G.I. Joe the movie, or Transformers the series to Transformers the movie? Because it seems like, was Transformers was first, or G.I. Joe was first, the movie?
They had a deal with, and I may not have my timeline 100% right, but the bottom line was this. They made a deal with Dino De Laurentiis to distribute 3 animated features that summer.
Okay.
And Dino De Laurentiis at this time was, you know, he was riding pretty high in Hollywood. He had his own distribution company, and he promised, we can get you X number of screenings per weekend.
Sure.
And being animated children's films, at that time, you usually got just a Saturday and Sunday matinee. You'd get like 2 or 3 shows on Saturday and Sunday.
Oh.
And then you wouldn't play Saturday night or Sunday night. And
really?
You wouldn't play during the week. Yeah, because they figured, well, these are kids' shows, and the kids are going to come out, and they'll only come out for the early shows. They won't be there for like the 9 o'clock show at night.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So there's logic to that.
Yeah.
And Dino De Laurentiis had apparently promised Hasbro 3 shows, you know, every theater that ran them would run 3 shows every day.
Yeah.
And so the first one that actually went into production was the My Little Pony movie.
Oh, okay.
And we did My Little Pony. I didn't work on it in an official capacity, but they gave me the script and said, you know, read it and make some suggestions. And basically the suggestions I made were, you've got all this magic that happens off camera. You know, it's not a cartoon show where we can't afford to do it. Just bring it on camera and turn it into a song. So,
yeah.
Like, I'm not taking credit for writing the songs, but I'm certainly taking credit for saying, well, you know, you could put a song here, you could put a song there, you can do all this other
stuff. Yeah, making it a musical. Yeah,
exactly.
Sort of.
Yeah. And they went for that. I mean, I'm speaking frankly, I think improved the film better than doing it without music. I got to back up here. Tony Randall was one of the voices. And he was on the David Letterman show when this thing premiered. And he comes on the David Letterman show, and he's promoting the movie.
Wow.
I mean, he's putting his shoulder to the wheel. He's
That's
talking
great.
About it. He's brought along a film clip. And Letterman is about to fall out of the chair laughing because,
yeah.
You know, like other people would promote their big budget
sure.
A-list movies. He's out here promoting My Little Pony.
Yeah.
And Randall does it with a completely straight face. Oh,
yeah.
No, this is a great animated film. You've got to take your kids to go see it. They'll love it, yada, yada. 6 months later, you know, the movie's no longer around. Randall is back on. And Letterman says, so what about that My Little Pony movie? Oh, that piece of crap?
Oh, man. Oh, no. Oh, no.
But, you know, I admired Randall for, you know, you did your job.
Yeah,
You were given a paycheck, and you went out and you helped promote the movie. Good for you.
That's great. That's great.
But anyway, so the My Little Pony movie was first. And then
and did it do well upon release, or?
Well, no, I'll get to that in a moment.
Oh, okay.
The next one out of the gate was going to be the Transformers movie.
Yeah.
And then the third one was going to be G.I. Joe.
Yeah.
And the Transformers movie
is incredible.
The writing,
by
let me
it's
okay,
incredible.
But I'm going to give an example on the. There's no one way to write a movie, write a story, a particular story. I mean, there's no one way. You can only write a screenplay this way. You can only write a novel that way. You can do whatever it takes to get the final form.
Yeah.
And Flint's approach was, it's like going to a salad bar, and you see all this cool stuff, and you just start piling it on your plate.
Yeah.
And eventually you get to a point where stuff starts falling off. You've just got too much on the plate, and it falls off.
Yeah.
And you either decide to scoop it up and put it back, which means something else falls off, or you let it fall off and you go look and see if there's something even more appetizing you want.
Yeah.
And so if you can imagine, Flint's approach to writing a story leaves a trail of discarded food, but he's got a big heaping plate full of all kinds of different stuff.
Yeah.
I take a much more methodical A to B to C to D type approach. And once I knew what I wanted to do with the G.I. Joe movie, the main story got written fairly quickly, but it was still scheduled to be the third film released.
Okay.
So I convinced them, you know, we've been doing this military series where nobody has gotten killed. You're going to cycle Duke out of the product line. Let's kill Duke off. Let him die heroically.
Yeah.
And the target audience, which was about 12-year-old boys,
yeah,
they're emotionally ready for that. They're ready to accept the fact that somebody can die heroically and whatnot.
Yeah.
And it would be sad, it would be shocking, but they could cope with it. They would realize it's just a cartoon.
Sure.
Well, Hasbro liked that and said, oh, that's a great scene. Why don't we kill off Optimus Prime?
Okay.
So they kill off Optimus Prime.
Uh-oh.
And yeah. I didn't know about this until after it was all done and it was in the editing stage.
Oh, wow.
And I said, but you can't kill a robot. I mean, if you take a robot and mash him flat and crunch him up and rip him to little itty-bitty bits, you can still rebuild him.
But
you
know, he's like an alien, right? They're exactly, like life forms.
Like, Star Wars, you know?
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
You know, you can just mash a robot up and he'll come back. A robot is not a living person.
Well, you know? It kind of depends on how you look at the Autobots, right? No?
Well, I'll grant you they're autonomous, but they're still robots. You can smash them and fix them.
Okay. You're the guy. You worked on it, so I'll let you roll.
I'm just saying, I mean, if we did a story where an Autobot lost all his limbs, as long as in the last scene we see the limbs being reattached, boy, feel as good as ever.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
Okay, fine. If we were to take Shipwreck and chop all his arms and legs off, we're not having that scene at the end of the story.
No, you're not.
So they kill off Optimus Prime, and the Transformers target audience was 9 years old.
Yeah.
And it hit them a lot harder than it would have hit a 12-year-old.
Sure.
And we had people calling up and complaining.
Wow.
Their kids were throwing temper tantrums and having hissy fits. I mean, Flint told about the kid who locked himself in his room. I mean, he said a closet, but it was his room.
Uh-huh.
Locks himself in his room for I don't know how long because he was mourning Optimus Prime's death.
Oh,
you know?
My gosh.
And
well, we were nerds. We were
And so they yanked out Duke's death scene, and again I protested. I said, no, this is the one time it makes sense. Leave it in.
Yeah, but yeah.
They took it out, you know. But anyway, going back to Dino De Laurentiis, had promised three showings on Saturdays and Sundays. This is my understanding of what happened.
Sure.
And for My Little Pony, he only got him two screenings on Saturdays and Sundays.
Yeah.
And then when Transformers came out, he was supposed to get the three screenings. You know, Hasbro was willing to, you know, okay, the first one out the gate, My Little Pony isn't that big. But when he couldn't get three for Transformers, they had a big fuss.
Okay.
And they ended up dropping the distribution deal.
Oh,
so
wow.
The G.I. Joe movie never was officially released theatrically. We had one screening at the San Diego Comic-Con where they mixed up the
reels.
Yeah, they mixed up reels two and three so that all of a sudden it became very disjointed.
Yeah.
But that was it, and that was the only time prior to The Egyptian that it was ever shown full screen in the theater the way it was supposed to be seen. And I have to say, once I finally saw the cleaned up, because we were running a work print in San Diego.
Oh, okay.
Once I finally saw the cleaned up, properly done and timed film in a theater, there are parts that I wish I hadn't written exactly that way, but I liked it. I thought it worked, and I thought it hung together for what it was. I would have still, you know, if I could have convinced Hasbro not gone with Cobra La. But,
Cobra La, know, La 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 La. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I have to explain that too.
Okay.
In the movie Lawrence of Arabia, there's a scene where these Bedouin women are acting as like living air raid sirens.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And they're basically on a mountain scanning the sky, and as they see these Turkish fighter bombers approaching, they turn and start making this incredibly piercing, shrill trill with their tongues.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't do it, but I mean, it's just incredibly loud and incredibly piercing.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, let's do something like that. If we're stuck with Cobra La, let's do something with Cobra La. So I had this idea that when they attack, the Cobra La troops, not Cobra troops, but specifically only the Cobra La troops would do that trill. They go Cobra La, and then they go this really high piercing trill.
Yeah.
And it would have worked done that way. But they had Dick Gaudier as Serpentor. And Dick Gaudier is a great voice actor. He's a funny comedian. I mean, really just top notch. He did a great job, you know, as Serpentor in the series and the movie. But Dick Gaudier's got a voice. It's just much too deep.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he goes, Cobra, la, 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 la. God, no, no. And I, when I heard it, I said, you've got to take that out. You've got to cut that. Oh, well, we can't. It's in the soundtrack. No, you just get rid of it. Just cut it out. Put in an explosion, something. You can't have.
Wow.
Well, it went. And, you know, again, if it had been done the way intended, I think it would have been worked with Dick Gaudier, and he was trying his best. Didn't work.
Oh, wow. Wow. Well, yeah. I mean, so we're coming up. I mean, we're sort of passing an hour, and you've been really generous with your time. I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but I do. Like, was that like heartbreaking for you that it didn't get released, or were you just like?
It was very frustrating. I won't say heartbreaking because at that point, I was kind of just. I won't say burned out. That's not what I was. But at that point, I was no longer surprised at.
Yeah.
You know, things not happening the way they were supposed to.
Yeah.
And I had certainly hoped that it would have gotten a theatrical release. I had hoped that when people saw it, they would say, well, you know, it was a good action film, a little goofy, but a good action film.
Okay.
And I would have, you know, hoped to have been able to continue working with Sunbow at that point. But for reasons known only to Hasbro, they decided to go with Deke for season 3 of G.I. Joe.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, at that point, I just said, you know, I've turned a corner here. My Hasbro experience is over.
Uh-huh.
And I'll just go on into other things.
Sure.
So I'm not heartbroken.
Yeah.
I will say that, you know, if I had a time machine or somebody gave me, you know, enough money and resources to do the Buzz Dixon release, I would go back and fix a few things.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, that's not going to happen, and so don't get your hopes up.
Yeah, I gotcha. So what are these books that you have coming out, just to, like, wrap it up? Because you said you had some projects coming up, and I don't want to just, like, leave you hanging without getting to, like,
what
you're working on.
I have one book. These are the term that's being used now is called new adult. It used to be young adult.
Okay.
And young adult used to be teenagers, but now they say new adult to indicate teen to mid-20s.
Really?
So these are new adult novels. The first one is called Poor Begotten Children of Eve, and it is... I describe it as a World War II Lord of the Flies with Catholic schoolgirls.
Oh, wow.
And it's about a group of teenage Catholic girls from a Catholic school. They are European and American kids whose parents work in the Philippines. They are being evacuated from the Philippines on the eve of World War II. Their plane is shot down. Most of them are killed, but six of them and a novice nun make it ashore to a deserted island. Uh-huh. And so they spend basically the rest of the war is raging all around them, and they're trying to survive on this island.
Oh, wow.
That one is ready to go, and it's just a matter of getting it up on Kindle.
Okay.
Yeah. The next one, the one that I'm working on right now, and I'm trying to get it complete. I had hoped to have it done by now, but events have conspired against me.
Sure, as they always
I'm
do.
I'm doing a G.I. Joe Kindle Worlds book.
Get
called
out.
The most Dangerous Man in the World. And it's going to be the story that I had come up with for to explain my origin of Cobra for the TV series. And basically, there's no Cobra Law, there's no Serpentor. This is what I would have told as the origin of Cobra if I had been given the chance to do it.
Wow, so, that's awesome.
This is an alternate take on the classic G.I. Joe characters.
Wow.
And then there's a third book that has been completed, and I'm in the rewrite phase of it, called The Rustlers of Rimrock, and it's about four girls who steal a herd of wild horses in order to get them to safety.
Oh, wow.
So it's a fast-paced modern Western adventure as they're trying to get this herd of horses across 100 miles of the worst territory imaginable.
Huh. And is that one new adult too? Or is
yes.
That-
Yes, oh, okay. That's also a new adult.
Gotcha. Wow. So yeah, you're keeping busy. You're right.
I'm trying to.
That's great. That's so great. Well, thank you so much for your time. I mean, we've been on for a while. I don't want to keep you. You're such a generous guy. Like
okay.
This is more than I could have expected. But thank you so much for coming on to a part-time family.
Well, I appreciate it.
No. I mean, honestly, okay. I said it at WonderCon. I'm gonna say it here on the air, like mm-hmm. you and many of your brethren are so responsible for like what I have grown up, like what I've become, you know what I'm saying, and the ambitions that I've had in my life, and you may not realize it, but you really laid the blueprint for a lot of kids' childhoods out there that have grown up. I mean, I know you said earlier you went to like a G.I. Joe con and stuff like that, but beyond that, there's there's positive aspects to it too. And I don't want you to like leave this interview without knowing like how much your work and obviously the work of others too has meant to us. So like when you were at the Egyptian and I ran into you at WonderCon, I was like, oh my God, this is the guy. so it just makes me very happy to have had you on.
Well, thank you.
Part-time fanboy. And just thank you for taking the time. And for anybody listening, this has been Buzz Dixon on Part-Time Fanboy. And he's got three books coming out. Please get them when they come out. And where can they find you on the internet?
Well, I'm on Facebook as okay. Buzz Dixon,
okay.
and they can find me at my blog, which is www.buzzdixon, all one word, BUZZDIXON, .com. And we are going to be launching a podcast of our own
in
the very near future.
Cool.
I'll be telling, a variety of stories about, my experiences in writing and whatnot.
Oh, that's
also,
great.
Also, experiences I've had at conventions or things that I've known of various writers and artists I've worked with.
Yeah.
So that will be announced sometime this summer.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, I look forward to that. I'll definitely be listening to it.
Great.
That's terrific.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you for coming on, Mr. Dixon. I really appreciate it. And my name is Christian Horn, and this has been another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. Thank you for listening.
Part-Time Fanboy. Part-time. Part-time fanboy.